support for the Financial Samurai podcast and the following message comes from Wonder Capital, the easiest way to invest in large-scale solar energy projects across the U.S. With Wonder, you can help finance renewable energy projects while earning up to 7.5% annually. To get started, visit wondercapital.com/samurai, S-A-M-U-R-A-I. Wonder Capital, where impact investing meets capitalism. Hello, everybody. It's Sam from Financial Samurai. And in this episode, we're going to talk about how we should always calculate the opportunity cost when making a major investment. I mentioned in a previous podcast that I was thinking about buying a larger home, about 3,900 square feet, or double the current size of my home because of ego and because of family and also because of the desire for profit. The home was asking $2.2 million, which is really good value based on the square footage, and I decided to lowball them at $1.95 million all cash. Now, after about a week, they came back and countered at $2.3 million or $100,000 over their asking price. That should give you a glimpse as to how absurd the San Francisco property market is. Someone gives you an offer and you counter $100,000 above what you were willing to accept. Well, the secret is in San Francisco, nobody really lists their house for what they would accept. They're always trying to game it and underprice it a little bit so that they can create a bidding war and have one silly buyer be at the top. Well, unfortunately for this seller and these agents, it's a pretty big surprise. They mispriced the home. Instead of pricing it at $2.2 million to try to get $2.4, $2.5 million, which is what they said they tried to do, they should have probably listed it at $1.99 million to try to get $2.3 or $2.4. Because once you cross that $2 million threshold, the demand for buyers drops off. And this is actually something really interesting I want to share with you guys as a tangent. There is a price point in your particular city where there's a lot of demand because a lot of people can afford it. Here in San Francisco, maybe places like New York, and Boston and LA and San Diego, that price point where there's a lot of demand is about $1 to $1.6 million. So essentially a dual income household that makes, let's say, $200,000 to $350,000 can afford that $1 million to $1.6 million price point. These are working professionals, 30 something years old, looking to buy a median sized home before they start a family. So this is a really common buyer demographic. But once you get to that $2 million price point, buying a home gets much more difficult. Think about it, 20% down on $2 million is $400,000, and then you have to carry a $1.6 million mortgage. I mean, that's a lot of money, maybe, what, $12,000 a month, depending on your interest rate. So the buyer demand drops off, therefore the value on a price per square foot goes up. And that is what I recommend all of you guys think about when you go out and purchase a property, is what is that step up in price point where the demand really falls up, where you get a much better price per square foot value. And then at some point, the price per square foot goes up again because people are just so rich that it doesn't really matter. And it's really rare to have like a 5,000 or 6,000 or 8,000 square foot home. And these homes are priced here in San Francisco at like $2,000 a square foot. It's a funny dynamic that you guys should all try to figure out. Ask your realtor, do some research on the value of moving up in price point. But anyway, enough about that. So since they countered me at $2.3 million, I just said, no, forget it. And I just said, no, thank you. And a couple weeks went by and they said, how about $2.2 million? So it was nice that they came down by $100,000, but the price still wasn't enticing enough given the amount of work that was involved in updating the home. I considered countering in writing with an offer of $1.9 million, so $30,000 above my original offer. But then I decided to write them this letter instead. And listen to this letter, because the letter's original intent was to convince them to sell to me somewhere close to $2 million, and that would be a happy median. But instead, the letter ended up convincing me to not pursue the deal any further. So gotta love the irony there. So this is the letter. Dear seller, thanks for the counteroffer, but we cannot afford this price. We went back a couple times to check out the foundation with a couple professionals, and there is foundation work that needs to be done to level the house and retrofit the house in case of an earthquake. This is San Francisco, after all. The city has already made it mandatory for wood frame multi-unit apartment buildings with garages to be retrofitted to the tune of $100,000 to $300,000 each. We believe it's only a matter of time before the city identifies pre-1970 wooden frame multi-story houses over a garage, which will also require retrofitting. So with addition to the remodeling work plan, we simply do not have enough funds left to comfortably afford this home. And then I go on and say, look, the real estate market is also at an all-time high, but it is slowing as interest rates are rising, rents are flatlining, and the stock market is down about 10% for the year. It's just kind of stuck here going up and down in this range. The stock market is foreshadowing a slowdown in corporate profits and job growth, right? Because as an investor, you pay for a company based on future earnings. So with the institution of the mortgage interest deduction and state and local income tax cap this year, it's an inevitability real estate prices will slow down. And I truly, truly believe this. And I'm trying to make them believe this so they can become more reasonable. So I continue. We need room in our budget to account for unforeseen expenses that come with remodeling an old house and dealing with new city retrofitting rules. At $2.2 million, it would make much more sense to simply buy a completely brand new home on the market for $2.7 million and save all the hassle and time, right? And then I conclude, finally, the alternative to buying the house is to simply reinvest the money in risk-free 10-year treasury bonds yielding 3%. So with a $2 million investment, we would earn $60,000 a year or $5,000 a month guaranteed without having to do any work or have any worry. A simpler life sounds pretty good to us as we take care of our baby boy. If you would like to reconsider our offer sometime in the future, let us know. Our lines of communication are always open. So this is a letter I spent about 10 to 15 minutes writing, and I thought it was a really good letter that tried to show our thought process and make them be more realistic on their asking price. But at the end of the day, I basically convinced myself that this is not a good buy. And the key paragraph, the key portion of this letter that I want to focus everybody on is the portion about opportunity cost. Man, earning $60,000 a year state income tax free is amazing. But the actual cost of owning a home goes beyond that $60,000 a year in opportunity cost. There's also property taxes to pay of about $25,000 a year. So even if I bought the house for $2 million, I would have to sink another $350,000 to $500,000 to fix the house up. And then there's the $85,000 a year in opportunity cost. We're talking about $2,435,000 to $2,585,000. And then you got to add in another $100,000 to $130,000 in taxes and commissions to sell the house. And there simply isn't enough profit buffer to account for the risk I would be taking. Using my example, I really want to encourage all of you to think about what the baseline opportunity cost is for making any type of investment that has risk. I use the 10-year Treasury bond yield as a barometer for opportunity costs. So right now, the 10-year bond yield is hovering around 3%. So you are guaranteed to get 3% on your money every year for the duration of the bond, right? You've got to hold it to maturity. So let me use a couple more examples to explain opportunity costs. So one, the S&P 500 index. Hopefully you all have some basic exposure to the S&P 500 index. The index is currently yielding around 2.5%. Therefore, you would get $50,000 in dividends each year if you invested $2 million. I'm just going to use $2 million just to be consistent. You expect the S&P 500 to return plus or minus 10% a year, which accounts for about, I would say, 80 plus percent of the returns of the S&P 500. Therefore, your potential return is negative 7.5% to positive 12.5%. How did I get those numbers? Well, negative 7.5% is simply an expected return of negative 10% plus a positive 2.5% yield. And then plus 12.5% is simply an expected positive 10% principal return plus a 2.5% yield. So in dollar terms, your expected return is negative $150,000 to positive $250,000. It sounds good because you wouldn't invest in something without a positive expected return. However, if you bake in the opportunity cost of losing a guaranteed 3% return on your $2 million or $60,000, the true expected return on the S&P 500 index is therefore negative 10.5% to positive 10.5%. So the negative 10.5% comes from a negative 10% expected return plus a 2.5% yield
minus 3% opportunity cost. And then the positive 10.5% comes from a positive 10% expected return plus a positive 2.5% yield minus the 3% opportunity cost. So the absolute dollar expected return is negative $210,000 to positive $210,000 from negative $150,000 to positive $250,000. The second example is real estate crowdfunding. You can buy individual deals or you can invest in various types of funds. I invested in a fund that targets a 15% return. And given I never believe in any stated target returns, and neither should you, let's cut that target investment return to 10%. So my expected return is $200,000 on $2 million. But of course, the 13 investments in the fund might end up losing me money. Hopefully it doesn't with so much diversification, but let's say it does. So let's say the potential loss is 5% or $100,000 loss. Therefore, the expected return range is negative $100,000 to positive $200,000, which is still a positive expected return, and therefore someone would make that investment. However, if you bake in the opportunity cost of losing a guaranteed 3% return on your $2 million, the true expected return on my real estate crowdfunding investment is negative 8% to only positive 7%, if I'm doing this right. So negative 8% comes from a negative 5% expected return plus missing out on 3%. So you plus the minus 3%, so that's negative 8%. And then the positive 7% comes from expecting a 10% positive return to missing out on 3%, so minus that 3%. So in other words, the expected return range is negative $160,000 to positive $140,000. Now that doesn't sound quite as good as negative $100,000 to positive $200,000 anymore, does it? So in other words, opportunity cost makes the downside loss even worse and the expected returns not as great. And when you're talking about lower expected return numbers, the difference gets magnified. The opportunity cost of not investing in a risk-free asset isn't as impactful when asset prices are rising rapidly. However, as soon as interest rates start to rise and the pace of asset appreciation starts to slow, opportunity cost really means everything. So I remember when the 10-year bond yield was only at 1.5%. The risk-free opportunity cost was insignificant. It really didn't excite me at all. So myself, along with other investors, prefer to take more risk for potentially higher rate of return. But with the risk-free rate at 3% now, it's finally getting a little bit enticing to slow down on those risk-loving asset investments and lower your risk profile a little bit, at least for me. It's a really rational thought process. If the risk-free rate ever gets to 10%, for example, you'd probably dump all of your assets into a risk-free asset class and then just chill back at night. So really, the key is to amass enough capital to the point where taking excessive risk is no longer necessary. Think about a scenario where you have $10 million liquid to invest and you could happily live off $250,000 a year in gross income. Why would you bother putting most of your $10 million in risky assets like stocks and real estate that could potentially lose you millions when you can earn $300,000 a year risk-free? Remember, you're already happy making $250,000 gross a year, so you have a 20% buffer. Why would you take any more risk? The only reason is greed, frankly. So in such a scenario, I would probably invest 40% of the $10 million in risk-free treasury bonds, 30% in AAA municipal bonds, 20% in stocks, and 10% in alternatives. So 30% in riskier assets that'll hopefully provide me some juice, but 70%, if it's earning 3 to 4%, that's enough for me. And I think if you do this, you'll end up leading a carefree, happy life, which is what having money should be all about. In conclusion, I want to say that opportunity cost is not just about lost guaranteed money. It's also about lost time and lost happiness. I think about the time I would lose if I bought this house and had to spend 4 to 8 months project managing and remodeling it. And then I think about the lost happiness that will ensue if I did all this stuff and had to deal with people who are perpetually late and perpetually over budget. That would really stress me out and decrease my happiness. So the older and wealthier you are, the more you should care about the latter, the lost time and lost happiness. After the age of, I would say, 50, It really no longer makes sense to hustle so hard because you already put in your dues. When you're in your 20s, 30s, maybe early 40s, that's the time to really burn the midnight oil and take some risks. But afterwards, once you have enough of a cushion where you can really start to breathe easier, it's much better to be much more conservative with your money, your time, and your state of being. Thanks so much, everybody. I hope this episode makes you and other people realize that splurging on items now really can detract from the future in terms of your earnings and your wealth. Anybody who invested their hard-earned money in the stock market or real estate market since around 2010 has probably doubled or tripled their money. Thanks so much. Support for Financial Samurai is brought to you by Wonder Capital, the easiest way to invest in large-scale solar energy projects across the U.S. Experts at Bloomberg estimate that $2.8 trillion will be invested in solar energy by 2040. And that's a great thing because electricity costs have gradually risen over time. With Wonder Capital's solar investment platform, individuals can now take advantage of this economic opportunity. Visit wondercapital.com/samurai to find out how you can begin investing in solar energy projects while earning up to 7.5% annually, while also helping in the fight against climate change. Again, that's wondercapital.com/samurai, S-A-M-U-R-A-I. Wonder Capital, where impact investing meets capitalism.